All right. We are in, still in Mark chapter 1, but we finished the first 15 verses, which is the first section. If you recall a little outline we had a while back. That outline there, the preparation is the first section there, the first 15 verses of Mark. I saw one of those things on the internet, it's called a meme, that was pretty cute. I didn't put it up here because I didn't think very many people would get it. But basically it talked about the introductions to each of the different gospels. How Matthew says, I want to prove to you that Jesus is a real person, is a king, by giving you this introduction with his genealogy. Luke says, I want to prove to you that he had how all these things began with John the Baptist and his birth, Jesus' birth. And John says, I want to prove to you that this really is God, that how important this is. And Mark says, let's get down to business. And it has a picture from some guy from Mulan, but I figure somebody might be able to get that. But I thought that was interesting. So he does get down to business. He has just 15 verses that has this with this introduction that we have here. And then we see that he is in Galilee. So on the board here, I have his Galilean ministry for the rest of chapter 1 up through near the end of chapter 8. Not quite the end of chapter 8, but near the end of it. So that's what I have up here. And then this thing that is, we got some of those out there on the table outside. So if you have this, this is a new king, this section here, up to the beginning of chapter 3. And then one of the commentaries had the rest of chapter 1 showing his popularity, and that's certainly the case. We see that he becomes very popular in the early part of his ministry. And so you may wonder, well, this class is called The Suffering Servant. How can he be popular and be suffering? Well, you don't get to suffer as much as he did without at some time being popular, because people love you, and then the other people who are in power get jealous, and then they want to do some terrible things to you as a result, and that's what happened to Jesus. All right, so we're going to look now at the first disciples who are called in verses 16 through 20. So, whoever's got that, please read, 16 through 20.
And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and brother Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishing. And Jesus said to them, follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men. They immediately left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little farther from there, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him.
All right. So Mark, along with Matthew and Luke, they only record the initial calling of 5 of the 12 disciples. And we see 4 right here. Peter, Andrew, James, and John. John, the Gospel of John, also adds the calling of Philip and Nathanael. Nathanael is generally believed to be Bartholomew, listed in some of the other names of all the apostles. So Nathanael, Bartholomew, same person. It appears that one of the things that I noticed that I found interesting, that Jesus seems to like to call brothers. And I don't know if there's a very important point there. I just thought it was an interesting thing to consider. He calls Andrew and Peter. Those are brothers. And he calls James and John. Those are brothers. But interestingly enough, there's another set of possible brothers in the list of the disciples. And look at chapter 2, verse 14. Somebody read that.
And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the receipt of custom, and said unto him, "Follow me." And he arose and followed him.
All right. So this is Levi, the son of Alphaeus, a tax collector. Do you know what he's called in other gospel accounts?
Matthew.
That's right. That's exactly right. In other gospel accounts, I think in the book of Matthew, Luke calls him Levi as well, but Matthew calls him Matthew. And so here we note that he is the son of Alphaeus. Do you know another disciple who was a son of Alphaeus? Go through the list of disciples in your brain if you memorize them at some point. All right, go to chapter 6. No, sorry, chapter 3, verse 18. Mark chapter 3, verse 18. James, the son of Alphaeus. Right? So could it be that Levi / Matthew and James are brothers if they're both the sons of Alphaeus? Very likely, if it's the same Alphaeus. So there's a possibility that it's a different Alphaeus. There's a possibility that one thing I had wondered, because the word son is in italics in my Bible, which means it's not there. I wonder if this could apply to Matthew and Thomas as well. Interestingly enough, Thomas is called the twin, right? In John chapter 20, he's called Thomas Didymus, which is the twin. Well, why wasn't his twin brother called? Maybe he was. Maybe he's one of these guys. I don't know. That's pure speculation. What we do know, James and John were brothers. This particular James, the son of Zebedee, were brothers. And Andrew and Peter were brothers. And we kind of have a good indication that maybe Matthew and James, the son of Alphaeus, were also brothers.
Could one of the other twin have died?
Possibly. That's true. That's a possibility. Good question. Good observation. All right. So, what does this tell you about families? If these brothers, if Jesus. One of the questions I have up here, why these men? Why were these particular men called? Well, God chose them, but there's got to be a reason.
If you choose somebody who's had a lot of education and background and that sort of thing and is in worldly ways, then you're going to have a hard time teaching them the basics. These people were probably righteous, I would assume, righteous to begin with, or at least amenable to it, to become more righteous. And they were young, so they had years ahead of them to be able to spread the gospel. Youngish.
John was the young one.
they also understood the concept of fishing with a net.
At least these four did, yeah.
And it came out of a preacher's sermon several years ago that I heard about the difference between using a hook and using a net. When you use a hook, you catch typically one fish. If you're using a net, you're casting a net, and you're making a broader sweep. But anyway, that's an analogy that they would understand, as Jesus said, "I'll make you fishers."
Yeah, that's another really good observation. One of the things you had pointed out, these were fairly righteous men. And we see, for one, Andrew, in John's account, we see an initial meeting between Peter and Jesus here in John chapter 1, verses 35 through 42. So this particular meeting that we see in Mark chapter 1 is not the first time that James, that Peter meets Jesus. So a lot of applications some people take from this this passage in Mark is that, well, he didn't have to know anything about Jesus. He just up and left. Well, that's not entirely how it worked. We see that there was an initial encounter in John chapter 1, and we see more explanation of what happened in this encounter in the boat in Luke chapter 5. In Luke chapter 5, Jesus performs a miracle with a catch of fish. And one of the things, he was a reasonably righteous man, one of the things I liked about what you mentioned there, what was Isaiah's reaction in Isaiah chapter 6 when he was up in heaven and he saw the vision of heaven? And what was his reaction? Do you remember? Woe is me, I am of unclean lips, of a people of unclean lips. I'm so awed by what I see here today. And he bows down and he just is, has such an extreme amount of humility in that moment. Peter has a similar reaction when he sees this miracle that Jesus has done with the catch of fish in Luke chapter 5. And he bows down and he's like, I am unworthy to be here. And so that's a connection that I see between Peter and Isaiah in their reactions when they encounter evidence of divinity. All right. So throughout this part of Mark, up until Mark chapter 3, Peter is not called Peter. Peter is called Simon. And I find that kind of interesting too, because in the other accounts, we see that the first time he's mentioned in Matthew, he's Simon called Peter. In Luke, he's interchangeably called Simon and Peter in the first encounters. He's just called Simon Peter at some point. And Mark, he's Simon up until Simon called Peter in Mark chapter 3. But in John, we see that he comes up and he's Simon, and he is, and Jesus gives him the name Peter. He is going to be as steady as a rock. Right? Now, that doesn't mean he always lives up to that name, does he? We see the only other time Mark calls Peter Simon is after that is in, I have that somewhere, Mark 14, verse 37. And that's when Jesus calls him Simon.
So names meant something back then. And what did Simon mean? Peter meant rock.
Right. It's a good question. Somebody could look that up. I didn't look that up before coming. I think Simon is is based off of Simeon, which is the name of one of the original patriarchs, right? The second born. There's Reuben and then Simeon. So I think it might be named after him in that way. But yeah. Peter, that's his, so Simon is his given name, but Peter is the name that the Lord gives him. So there's an additional weight added there. All right.
Well, I understand it too.
Yes.
Mistaken that the name Peter or Petros, is that what?
Yeah, Petros, yeah.
The actual definition of it is not rock as we think. When I think of a rock as something kind of hefty, but more like small stone. And that's a differentiation between, that's a differentiation between Peter, the small stone, and the rock on which Christ is going to build his church, which is the faith
right
Peter had.
And Matthew 16, I think that's what you're thinking of. Did you?
I Googled it.
Yeah.
It says, New Testament, New Testament Greek from form of the Hebrew name Simon means he has heard.
He has heard.
A name given to him by Jesus because of the apostle, his name had been common in the Christian world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I got basically the same thing I was interested in too. It means listen.
Yeah, listen. And certainly that's what Simon did. And whenever Jesus calls him Simon, he's like, listen up. You got to listen to what's going on here. So that's a good point, because he is, usually when he calls him Simon, Peter is showing a bit of weakness at that particular point, showing that he's not quite living up to the Peter moniker yet. All right. So, verse 17. So they're called in verse 16, and verse 17 is the specific call that is talked about here. Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men. Dan already talked a little bit about this, but they were to become fishers of men. Are we to become fishers of men? Yeah. Yeah. By extension. Because later we see that in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, teach them all things that I've commanded you, right? And one of the things that Paul had, or that Jesus had commanded them, was to be fishers of men, right? I'll make you to become fishers of men. How do we become fishers of men?
Well, it says right there, same line, follow me.
Yeah. So that's one part, yeah, follow him.
Teach others.
Teach others. You know, there's a lot of... basically, we have to learn how to become fishers of men. We have to educate ourselves on certain aspects of human nature to see what works. Jesus, or study the Gospels as well, because Jesus was a fisher of men, was he not? And maybe and certainly follow his examples in how he did these things and how he cast his net, as Dan pointed out earlier. So follow his examples. And certainly there are several examples that we see in the gospel accounts for his how he cast that net. He was that fisher of men. All right, any other comments? Usually we talk about this particular verse a lot in various settings, so I'm kind of not talking about it too much, but if you wanted to say something about that, that's fine. Go ahead.
When Jesus was on that boat, he told the men to throw a net on a certain side, and they caught so many fish, they about tipped the boat over.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what happens in Luke chapter 5. That's why Peter, when he sees this particular miracle, he's like, I'm not worthy to be here. This is an amazing miracle. And so then he follows Jesus as a result, or after this particular event. One of the things that Luke also mentions is that James and John are working with Peter and Andrew. They're working together in their as fishermen, but James's, or the boat that James and John are in, is a little bit further up, as we see here. Then immediately they left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little farther from there, a little farther, so Zebedee's boat is a little bit further up, and he saw James and John. They were on Zebedee's boat. And it says here that they were mending their nets. They weren't fishing at that moment because something had broken in their nets. And they were mending them, putting it together. And
they were preparing to fish.
They were preparing the fish. That's right. Just as we ought to prepare to fish too, right? For as being fishers of men. Yes.
And when you're fishing in certain areas, there's coral and stuff like that. So when you drag the net, it tears, so they have to repair it.
All right. And perhaps some rocks, too, that might be around, and other things under the surface that we just can't see that tear the net. So that's a good point, yeah. All right, so one of the things that kind of strikes me in some of the other accounts, it just says that they left Zebedee here in verse 20. And immediately he called them, Jesus called James and John, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat. Now, none of the other accounts that I recall mention hired servants. So you might think by reading those that James and John just left their father high and dry. But that's not the case. He had some hired servants and Zebedee working with Andrew and Peter as fishermen. They were, that's their profession. That's what they were doing beforehand. And so Zebedee had help. He wasn't just left there. So, and we don't really see any other indication before this that James, about how James and John met Jesus, just as Andrew and Peter had met him. Remember, Andrew was a disciple of John the Baptist. He had gone to Peter and said, "Hey, check out this guy, Jesus." And Peter meets him and says, and Jesus says, "You know, you are now Cephas," which is translated Peter. And so a little bit later, who knows how long, Jesus encounters Andrew and Peter on their boat and calls them. And so he comes and has the miracle that's performed there as well. All right. So, whatever the case, here's the main point that I want to get to. And I think the main point of this particular section, aside from, hey, this is how these four men were called, but they were willing to leave their livelihoods and their families to follow Jesus. Let's turn quickly over to Mark chapter 10 and verse 28. Somebody read that.
Then Peter began to say to them, "See, we have left all and followed you."
They left all. Now, we don't want to go too extreme on that term all, because in a little bit later in Mark chapter 1, we read that Peter had, once he had left him at this point, a little bit later in Mark chapter 1, we see that he goes to his house in Capernaum, and he has a mother-in-law. So he didn't leave his wife, he didn't leave his house, although he did leave his house in the sense that he had gone and traveled with Jesus, but his house was still in Capernaum. So he didn't leave every little thing, but he did leave quite a bit. He left his job, he left his livelihood. He left how he was going to pay the bills, as it were. So, what are we willing to give up to follow him? While Peter said he had given all, let's look at Mark 10. If you're still at Mark 10, look at verses 29 through 31 and see what Jesus said in response to Peter's comment. Whoever's got that?
So Jesus answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's, who shall not receive 100-fold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters, mothers and children, and the lands with persecutions, and in the age to come eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first."
Those folks were willing to leave all. And Peter had no expectation, I don't think, about what was going to happen, or no understanding of what was to happen with this ministry with Jesus. I mean, he saw the miracle that he had performed with the boats, but other than that, and he had Andrew's word when it came to what happened with the baptism of Jesus. But the question then is, what were they willing to give up? What had they given up, and what are we willing to give up? Even though we haven't seen these miracles, we have them written down. Peter was willing to leave all these things and And Jesus says in that passage, people are, if you're willing to leave these things, then you are, then you have some great things coming for you. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean physical things. That doesn't necessarily mean material blessings. We see the outcomes of all of the apostles. All of them died by martyrdom, except for one, and he was exiled on an island. So, you know, there's no hope necessarily of physical blessings here on this earth. No biblical hope. We might have some hope in some manner for physical blessings, but there's no promise. That's probably a better word. No promise of physical blessings in the New Testament, except for necessities, of course, as we see in Matthew chapter 6. Certain necessities that are given to us. But even then, even if our necessities aren't met, we have to trust in God. We talked about that a little bit on Wednesday, about the suffering that we face. How should we respond to suffering? Psalm 13. We pray, we rejoice, we trust in God, and we sing. That's what Psalm 13 tells us. And suffering, those are the things that we ought to do.
Wasn't it Paul that suffered with something in his side?
Well, he calls it the thorn in the flesh. Now, we're not exactly sure what that thorn in the flesh was. But it was something that he had prayed God that it would be relieved of him. But God said, my grace is sufficient for you. So that's true. All right. So, we didn't quite delve into the next question that I have on the board as much. We did talk about it a little bit. Why these men? Not just the fishermen, but also all of the disciples that we see. One of the things about all these disciples is that they come from all different walks of life. We have the smelly fisherman. No offense, Art. we have the fishermen that are there. The four fishermen. We have a tax collector, and then on the other hand, we have Simon the Canaanite, talked about in Mark chapter 3. Luke calls him the zealot. Zealots were very against the Roman government. And yet, tax collectors were considered to be collaborators with the Roman government. And yet, both of these men were willing to work together for the cause of Christ. We see these fishermen, and we see the scholar that Paul was later on. We see that these men were all willing to come together, despite their differences, because of their one goal of being fishers of men. That's a remarkable thing, yeah.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that they were all Jews, so they were had a background in the Law and the Prophets. To understand the prophecy of the Messiah and the other things.
Right. Well, even so, they had different schools of thought. They had different ideas for how that should be, how that should come about. Not only that, we have Thomas, who was considered to be a little bit more skeptical than others. We have Judas, of course. Judas Iscariot, who turned out to be a traitor. But
even he had a role.
Even he had a role. He carried the money. Now, he was a bit of a thief, John tells us, but he still had his role. So, we've talked about all those. What about these four fishermen? Why choose fishermen? Doesn't that seem kind of interesting, kind of odd? Well, for one, they had the metaphor that we have here with being fishers of men. So just as Dan had mentioned earlier, you know, they had experience casting the net to catch a lot of fish, and so we have this metaphor that we can we can take for ourselves and understand, hey, this is how we're going to do this. You, just like you were fishermen, you will now be fishers of men. And not only that, but a third of his disciples were fishermen. We see these four men, 4 out of 12, were fishermen. And three of these were part of his inner circle. So of all the disciples he had an inner circle of 12. And of those 12, we had three, we might call them best friends, Peter, James, and John. And so we had an inner circle and an inner circle. And so that's what we see of Jesus' disciples. He did have other disciples besides the 12. We see that in Acts chapter 1 and in several other places. Luke 24 mentions Cleopas and some other person there. We do see that he had other disciples, but it was these 12 who were of that inner circle. And then the three who were even closer to him, as we'll see in some other places, only those three went with him in certain situations. So I find that fascinating, just to consider that these three men were willing to do all these things. I have some maps up here, which is why I dimmed the lights a bit. Capernaum is, or I've already dimmed it. Yeah, so appreciate it though. So we have the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum is up here. He's walking along the Sea of Galilee. So he's walking along the Sea of Galilee, and he's likely near Capernaum, which is right up here. So it's probably around here somewhere, I'd imagine, maybe over here, where he sees James and John and Peter and Andrew fishing, comes up. And then in the next section, we're going to see that they go to the synagogue. This is the synagogue in Capernaum, right over here. That blue speck that you can't read, I'm sure, because it's small. But that is Capernaum there. This is a map I showed last week where Capernaum and Bethsaida are up here, perhaps here or over here. And that could be where Peter's house was, or Peter's house could have been in Capernaum. Looking at Mark, it seems as though it's right there. But Mark has a tendency to make things seem closer or more immediate than they are. But that's what we see there. And then a closer up of Capernaum. And then here's that synagogue right there. Capernaum is a very small place. We have a few minutes. I'll talk about Capernaum a little bit now because that's the next section up here, verses 21 through 28. Looks at a particular event in Capernaum where Jesus casts out a demon in the synagogue. And see, so he goes to Capernaum, and in verses 21 through 22, and they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. So a few things about Capernaum. First off, this was Jesus' base of operations. We see in Matthew chapter 4, verse 13, that indeed this was, Matthew 4, verse 34. Misread my notes here. Matthew 4, 34. No, I'm sorry. I did read it right. Matthew 4:13. Can't talk right now. 4:13 says, "And leaving Nazareth, he came to and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali." So that's where he is at this point, in that particular region, in Capernaum, near the Sea of Galilee. He appears to stay in or around Capernaum at least until Mark 4:34. That's where I mix those up in my notes here. Capernaum is translated as Village of Nahum. Do you recognize that name, Nahum, at all? It's one of the books of the Bible, maybe?
I think you're pronouncing it different than I do.
Oh, how do you pronounce it?
I don't remember now that you said it. That's what I
didn't recognize. Maybe Nahum? Some people don't pronounce the H. I'm emphasizing the H because of I want to. I like to. Nahum. But yeah, Nahum is one of the books of the Bible, one of the minor prophets. He is one that speaks about Nineveh and about their downfall after Jonah. If you recall, Jonah has his preaches about the downfall of Nineveh, and they repent, and they aren't destroyed. Well, about 100 years later, Nahum comes out and says, man, you've gone bad again. And Nineveh is later destroyed. So I say all that to say that there is no clear connection between Capernaum and Nahum, despite the name. Perhaps it could be some other guy named Nahum that is here in this particular case. Capernaum was founded after the Babylonian captivity in the intertestamental period. So in between Malachi and Matthew, Capernaum was founded. You'll never find Capernaum mentioned in the gospel account, before the gospel accounts in the Bible, because it wasn't founded until after the captivity. It had a population of about 1,500 people. That seems very small, true, but it was a fairly small village. We can see that right here. But that also meant you had a potential of 1,500 people in the synagogue, because they were all Jews, right? And so if they're devout Jews, they're going to worship in the synagogue. And so that's what we see very likely happening in a little bit in Mark chapter 1. All right. They were worshiping on the Sabbath. And the Sabbath is what day of the week?
Sunday.
The last day of the week. It's Saturday. Sunday, or the Sabbath is the last day of the week. We see this in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8 through 11. We see 7 days you shall, or 6 days you shall work, and on the seventh day you shall rest. And what is the seventh day of our week? Saturday, the last day of the week. So that is when they worshiped. Now, of course, they had the way they did their times. It was from sundown to sundown the next day. So their Sabbath began sundown on Friday for us and ended sundown on Saturday. So that was their Sabbath day. This was a day to keep, a day to remember. And on this day, the Jews were commanded to rest. And it also became a day of worship for them. The Jews developed the idea, at least this is a common idea, developed the idea of the synagogue in the Babylonian captivity, because they are far away from home, far away from the temple. They can't go return to worship. So they decide to gather themselves up and say, we're going to worship in together in Babylon. And so that's where the idea of the synagogue came, and it didn't go away. When they returned, they kept that idea up, the idea of the synagogue. Going to the synagogue was not unlike going to church, as we commonly call it, going to worship. In the synagogue, they had a chest with scrolls in it, so the basic layout of a synagogue. They had a chest somewhere with some scrolls in it, along with a raised platform and a desk for the readers and teachers. They had some lamps and benches for the congregation. The funny thing is, back then, typically the teacher would sit, and everyone else would stand. Although in this case, in the synagogue, I suppose they would sit. But the teacher would sit up at a desk and read what he wanted to read.
Oh, if he's working off scrolls, he had to have somewhere to put them.
Yeah, that's right. That's what the desk was for. And he had a raised platform, kind of like what we have here. All right. It is also believed that ancient Christian worship, their services were modeled after synagogue worship. So I mention that because the ancient synagogue worship is not too dissimilar from how we worship. Now, it's different from how a lot of denominations worship, but it's not too different from how we worship. Because it is, again, ancient Christian services were based, are believed to have been based off of the Jewish service in the synagogue. All right. One interesting thing is that those who were asked to speak in the synagogue were rabbis, scribes, or even a special visitor. Do you remember what happened in Acts chapter 13? And I'll end with this. Do you remember what happened in Acts chapter 13? In verses 14 and 15, Paul and Barnabas show up in a particular synagogue, and the leader of the synagogue said, "If you have got something to say, Paul, say it." And so Paul, being a special visitor, comes out and starts preaching to the people the gospel. And that's an amazing opportunity they had. And so Jesus had that opportunity here in Capernaum when he was preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God, as we saw earlier in verse 16 or verse 15. All right. So Jesus would qualify as a special visitor. Next week, we are going to look at Jesus' teaching with authority and the miracle that he performed here in the synagogue. I want you to think about this for one second. I'll leave you with this thought. What if someone were to stand up and shout things in the middle of a worship service? You're like, what is this guy doing? Well, that's what happened back then. And we'll talk more about that next week.